Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. If you're hiring, with Indeed, you can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on your short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Get started at Indeed.com/NPR podcast.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. What is the point of music? Why do we need it? Those are the questions that violin virtuoso Lucia Micarelli seeks to answer as she ranges far and wide across America's musical landscape. She's a Juilliard-trained child prodigy who brings breathtaking technical skill and emotional sensitivity to classical music. Add to that a childlike openness to the improvisational possibilities of jazz or the guitar-driven growl of classic rock. When you put it all together, you have a masterful musician who can command a stage performing with a symphony orchestra or, say, Jethro Tull. And oh, by the way, you might have also seen her on HBO's Tremé, too. This hour on Point, looking for meaning in music with Lucia Micarelli. You can join us on air or online. What's your question for the celebrated violinist? What do you want to know about how she blends classical with rock, jazz with old-time fiddle tunes? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or you can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. And Lucia Micarelli joins us now. She's in Pasadena, California today. Her new album is called An Evening with Lucia Micarelli, and it's set for wide release later this month. It features 16 songs from a live PBS special that aired nationwide last spring. Lucia Micarelli, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. This, what we're listening to right now, it's called Ladies Fancy from your new album, right?
Yeah, it's an old-time fiddle tune that I actually learned from a family of old-time fiddle players that I met. When I was in New Orleans working on Tremé, she was actually the girlfriend of one of the musicians that I was working with, and she was a fiddle player, and she started telling me about old-time fiddle, and I was like, what's that? I thought, like, there's one kind of fiddling. It's just fiddling. And she was like, no, there's bluegrass and there's Cajun and there's old time and there's Irish and there's so many different kinds of fiddling. And so she started teaching me about old time fiddle playing. And then she introduced me to her dad, who is also an old time fiddle player. And I just got so into the music that I went out to Philadelphia and spent like a week with them just learning some of the tunes. And this is one of the tunes that they taught me. And I just thought it was so much fun.
And you were able to play it like that just after a week?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, if you ask them, they would tell you that I wasn't doing it properly in the tradition. But I think I'm doing it in the right spirit. I mean, I ended up sort of rearranging the tune, which is sort of originally for two violins that play mostly in unison. And I rearranged and expanded it to fit with my group. So now it's two violins and viola plus upright bass and cello and, you know, I have to put my own little twist on it, but it's definitely with all due respect to the old-time fiddle tradition.
Yeah, I suppose the tone of my question came off wrong, because what I was getting at was, wow, that's really good for not having been trained in the old-time fiddle tradition.
Well, I still have a long way to go, probably, yeah, in terms of getting it perfectly right in that tradition. Yeah. But, you know, it's so cool that I met these musicians and that they just invited me to their home. And then suddenly, you know, I was in this immersive old-time fiddle workshop. Yeah. I think that's so generous and so kind and really amazing.
Well, you know, in a bit, I want to talk with you in a lot more detail about how omnivorous you are about American music, and especially sort of how a lot of that was unleashed through your time, four seasons on Tremé. But can we step mm-hmm. back here? Let's go backwards in time a little bit first, actually, for folks who may not know your story as well as they should. So you were, what, three when you first picked up a violin?
Yeah, I was three. My mother made me do it. I know. I mean, a lot of people are like, oh my goodness, did you always know? It's like, I didn't really know. I know my mother really wanted me to play music. I think she had always wished that she played music. And so, she decided really early on that I was going to take music lessons. And actually, she wanted me to be a pianist. And so when I was three, she took me to the local Suzuki school. At the time, I was living in Queens, New York. And she took me to the school and said, you know, we'd like to start her on piano lessons. And they told her that my hands were a little too small and that I should come back in a year. And then my Korean mother's response was, no, no, no. What can she start now? She's not going to wait a year. So they started me on violin. And then I just sort of, I really took to it. I really liked it.
Okay, so because that was going to be my next question, because there's a difference between being encouraged at a young age to mm-hmm. being encouraged and liking it, as you said, and in what, 3 years later, standing in front of the Honolulu Symphony Orchestra and soloing at the age of six. So, I mean, you were a prodigy.
I mean, I guess I was a prodigy. I always imagined that one would feel more prodigious when it was happening. You know, like if you were really a prodigy, you would be sort of like, wow, I am really prodigious right now. But it was all just what it was, you know. I didn't think anything of it. I got really into the violin and I worked really hard at it. I'm pretty nerdy in general, and I think I really liked having a thing to do, and I really liked having something to focus on, and I enjoyed practicing, and I really liked music. I mean, from a very young age, I just really loved playing music. It made me feel really emotional, and I liked having all those feelings, and I don't know, things just sort of happened.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is there's always this question for people who are as, again, prodigious is the only word I can think of, or super supremely talented at a young age as you were, about, you know, whether or not it's love and passion for the music that's driving them, or something else. So, I mean, is this what you wanted for your life? Are you where you want to be right now?
Yeah, you know, this is what I want. I remember a few years ago, I went to go visit my mom, and she had dug up some like little journals that I had kept when I was a kid. And I found this journal from when I was six. And I mean, it's so obnoxious, but I had written in this journal, when I grow up, I want to be a violinist, because I am only 6 years old and I am already in Suzuki Book 4. And but it was like this thing I always imagined. I really don't remember, because I started so young, I don't remember a time that I didn't play the violin.
Yeah.
I have no memories from before playing the violin. And it's always been a thing in my life. It's always been something that I was serious about. And I just always wanted to do that, to the point where I never really imagined ever doing anything else, you know? And so even now, as an adult, I'm kind of like, wow, you know, if I had to do something else, it would be a it would be a struggle. I've spent such a long time, and this is sort of what I always wanted to do.
Yeah. I mean, so you went to Juilliard when you were 11, and then the Manhattan School of Music at 17, and you were taught by some pretty incredible people at Juilliard. And so you've had this career that keeps growing and growing and growing. But let me just ask you a super basic question, if I could. When you're on stage and you're playing, no matter what it is, it could be, you know, a violin concerto, or it could be, you know, what we heard you do a little earlier. But how does it feel? How do you feel when you're playing the violin?
When it's going well, when I think it's the best for me, like when I don't mean when I'm technically playing well, I just mean when I'm really in it. To me, that means it's going well. It's when I'm really in it and I get lost in it, it just feels like I'm very, very, very present, and at the same time, almost a little bit out of my body, you know? So it's almost like being so in the moment that I'm not worried about anything. I'm not thinking about what's coming. I'm not even thinking about notes. It's almost just like the music is coming through me. And especially, you know, being on stage, I love the collaborative aspect of what I do. I love that I play with other musicians. And so that feeling is just so exhilarating to me that there can be a group of us and we can all be lost in this moment together. And somehow we're together, but we're more. We're more than just however many people it is. We can create something better,
yeah,
you know, than any of us could create alone. So when it's good, it feels almost a little bit out of body. And, you know, it sounds cheesy, but there's something a little bit spiritual about it for me. And, you know, so it's, and I'm always really, really grateful. And when I'm playing shows, there's at least one moment during the show where I kind of look around, I look at the audience and I look around at my friends and the people that I'm playing with. And I just kind of get a little teary being like, this is so amazing that I get to like play music that I love with people that I love. And there's people here who want to share in that and hear it, and they're open to it. And it's just like, what an amazing little vibe to have in a room right now, you know?
I loved hearing that, because I'm going to come back to this question multiple times with you over the course of this conversation, because I read in another interview, and I quoted you at the top of this hour, that you said you ask yourself, what is the point of music, right? Like, what is so essential about it that we've done it for so many thousands of years and keep doing it? So is what you said, we just got a couple seconds before the break, but is what you said part of your answer to that? Like, that, you know, to be connected, to feel that out-of-body experience? Okay.
It's absolutely to be connected and to share with people, you know? It's a form of communication.
Yeah. Well, we will talk more about that when we come back. We are speaking with Lucia Micarelli. She is a virtuoso violinist with quite an interesting career. We'll go into the break here listening to Lucia playing with Josh Groban. You might have heard of him. This is You Raise Me Up. In 2004, live at the Greek, it's a show in Los Angeles that she played at with Josh Groban. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. To more than I can be. You raise me.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hi, I'm Daniel Alarcón, host of NPR's Spanish language podcast, Radio Ambulante. We tell engaging, one-of-a-kind stories that give you a more nuanced sense of Latin America and the U.S. Latino community today. From events that are changing the political landscape to intimate stories about everyday people. Listen to Radio Ambulante on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, that is Nocturne from Bohemian Rhapsody by Lucia Micarelli. It's from her 2004 album, Music from a Farther Room. Lucia is a Juilliard-trained violin prodigy. She's done a lot of great work with a number of high-profile musicians well outside the world of classical, and we're going to talk to her about that. But we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And Lucia's got a new album out. It's coming out later this month. It's called An Evening with Lucia Micarelli, and it features 16 songs from a live PBS special that aired nationwide last spring. So, Lucia, Nocturne from Bohemian Rhapsody. Tell us about this. When were you introduced, first of all, to this whole world of music outside of classical music?
Okay, so until I was 17, I only listened to classical music. And then when I was 17 and I just started college, so I was let out of my little bubble and I was in school and I was around other people. A friend of mine made me a mixtape. And on this mixtape, it had, or a mix CD rather.
Okay.
And on this mixtape, and he was a classical musician, but he was a little less sheltered, I guess. And so on this mixed CD, there was like Miles Davis and Coltrane and also like Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd. And I had never heard any of this stuff before. And I was just like, my mind was just so blown. I was like, oh my God. And then, of course, which I think is very normal, mostly for like dudes who listen to classic rock for the first time, like a guitar player's like, all I wanted to do is play all of the guitar solos on the violin. And I just thought that would be the coolest thing. And so that was kind of, you know, around that time was when I started getting really into classic rock, but also was the time I started getting into jazz. I just had never heard, you know, I remember the first time I heard Coltrane, I just didn't even understand. I was like, this is just so free and it feels so spontaneous. And is he just playing whatever he wants or is this written? You know, because up until that point, it's like all I ever played was written music and classical repertoire music. So it was just like, what am I hearing right now?
Did it come to you at the right time in your life? Because I'm wondering, you know, training at the highest levels of classical violin as you did for so many years has got to be intense. And is the training very prescriptive? And I just wonder if hearing this music and, like you said, like perhaps the freedom in it just came to you at the right time.
I think it did come to me at the right time. I mean, I'm really glad, you know, now, of course, looking back, I have 20/20 vision, right? So looking back, I'm really glad that I did have such a long time of just being very focused on my classical foundation. And I realized that that's been a great thing for me. But, when I was 17, 18, I first discovered this other music, and then that was also my first sort of understanding of like, oh, you know, not all people who play music play written music. They improvise music, or they, you know, you can write spontaneously. And actually, at the time, my initial feeling was frustration, and you know, where I remember, for quite a few years, I was really obsessed with this idea of like, well, you know, I along with many other young students in conservatories all over the world are trained to play music at such a high level and with such facility and technical ability, and yet I was never taught to improvise. I was never taught all these other things that kind of help take that technique and that facility and, you know, use it out in the world and apply it to more things. And I just remember being, you know, so like, for example, when I was 17, 18, and I first started getting into the idea of improvising, I had a friend who was able to improvise and was also a classical musician. And I went to him and I said, I really want you to teach me how to do what you do. And one of the ways that he taught me was by throwing me these, you know, little gigs. And one of the first gig that he threw me was like to play with an R&B band at some bar in Philadelphia. And so I remember going into a rehearsal with this band, and we're in this rehearsal space, and they're like, okay, this is one of the songs we want you to play on. It's really simple. There's only like four chords. We're going to play the song for you once, and you just listen to it, and then you can play something. They played it through once for me. And I was just like a deer in the headlights. I just didn't know what to do. So then they played the song again for me, and I still didn't know what to do. And I just remember the bass player looks up at me in this rehearsal space, and he goes, did you say you went to Juilliard? You know, and I was so horrified. And I had this thought of like, oh, my goodness, you know, I've been playing since I was three. I went to Juilliard. And meanwhile, I do not know what to do on my instrument if I'm not told. And that really frustrated me. And so that was an impetus for me to like try to be able to have a voice as a musician, regardless of what situation I'm in.
Oh, this
you know,
is...
and so that's been a driving thing for me my whole life is like, look, like I want to be a musician, not just like a classical violinist. I'm a musician, you know,
yeah.
So I should be able to make music under whatever circumstances.
Well, this is so interesting. Has that drive and I guess that brand new skill set that you got as well, has that fed back into how you play classical?
I think so. I do think that it, you know, up until that point, I was very sort of studious and very much focused on being a soloist. And so you just spend a lot of energy, you know, practicing your part and trying to make it perfect. And when I started being more interested in improvising, I also started becoming more interested in classical chamber music. And I realized that like a lot of my growth at that time was focused on listening. Rather than, you know, it wasn't so much what am I playing and am I playing everything right? It was sort of being really opening my ears and listening to what are these other musicians that I'm playing with doing, and how do I have a dialogue with them?
Yeah.
Because music, you know, when you're playing with other people, it's a conversation, and it's all response, like call and response, and you're always interacting with somebody. And up until then, I was pretty much, it was more of a recital, you know,
uh-huh.
like I would practice and then I'm going to play my part. And that was the point where I started realizing like, oh, music is so much about communication between people, and I really have to listen to what other people are doing. And that absolutely feeds my classical playing.
Right.
You know, because of course that's still the point. Even in classical playing, it's all about every person interacting with each other.
Yeah. You know, I was going to ask you about also the fact that, especially when I hear it in Bohemian Rhapsody, that there are symphonic elements to a lot of classic rock, and that's a good bridge to the skills that you already had as an incredible classical violinist. But before we could talk so much about every single piece that we're going to hear today, and we actually have people who want to talk to you, Lucia. So I'm just going to get a couple of callers here, and then maybe we'll talk about Treme, because that's a big part of your career. So let's first, though, go to Janice, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. You're on the air, Janice.
Hi, Lucia. This is such a great interview, and I have a daughter who is 14. She is in the Baltimore Symphony Youth Orchestra, and she is always very nervous when she has to play. And I wanted to ask you, if you were ever nervous, how did you deal with your nerves? That's my first question. The second question is, as her mom, how can I help her to just be as free as you are? Because I tell her all the time, I'm a singer myself, but I try to tell her, you know, she loves playing, but I tell her, you've got to feel free. You have to want to make music, like all the things you're talking about, you know, have a conversation when you're playing, you know, chamber music, come out of that box. As her mom, how can I help her do that? It's just so great to talk to you. I'm going to get your recording. I've got to tell my daughter about you, because I'd never heard of you before.
Aww.
And I have to get her tuned into what you're doing.
Oh.
Great.
Well,
Janice,
thank you so much. Lucia, what do you say?
First of all, how awesome, Janice, that you're a singer and now you're passing on this love of music to your daughter. That is so cool. I love that so much. That makes me really happy. That's a big part of what I think music is that history and sharing and, you know, being able to, I love that, like, you're going to be able to play music in your family, which I just love. That's so cool. First question, nerves. Yeah, I get nervous too. And most of my colleagues, most of the musicians, I know we get nervous. It's for me personally, it's something that's always there. I always do get nervous before I have to perform. But, you know, obviously with experience, you learn to cope with it. What I've found is that I can't make the nerves go away, but over time, I've learned that it's just part of it. I try to play little mind games with myself and tell myself, you know what? It's not so much nerves as that you're just really excited. That helps.
I've actually been told that, reframe it.
And I'm not nervous. I'm not scared. I'm really excited. And you think about the feelings that you're having, to think about that adrenaline and being like, this is going to help me. This adrenaline is good energy. This is going to help me be, you know, really sharp on stage and be really ready for anything. And also just sort of, there's also a point where you have to just put it aside. And that's something I've learned more recently as an adult, just that, because there have been moments where I just felt like so overwhelmed with nerves that I was like, why do I even do this? I can't handle this. And I realized over time, you know, you can reframe it and give it a decent amount of attention. You give it respect. And then you also just say, you know what? I know you're there. I'm not asking you to leave. I'm just asking you to get out of the way because I got stuff to do. And sort of just mentally sort of being like, you know, you can stay here, but you have to stay in the corner and be quiet because I'm busy, and just sort of move on, you know. And so maybe that's something that you can tell your daughter to do, is just, you respect it. You know it's there, and you just let it be there. Don't fight it, but just move past it. Just take a deep breath and realize that's just going to be part of it. And in terms of being freer, I think it's so great that you're encouraging her to be free and to, you know, to have a large appetite for music. I mean, that's all I could suggest, is that you just share a lot of different kinds of music with her. She's going to have to find that inspiration on her own. You know, you aren't going to be able to make her see something. Yeah. She's going to have to see it on her own. But hopefully, if she can have a lot of influences, there's going to be things that inspire her to push out of her comfort zone. But well, I think that, yeah, Janice is doing a great job.
Absolutely.
Just from what she was saying.
Now, Lucia, you know what we have to talk about for a little while at least. Your four seasons on HBO's Tremé, David Simon's fantastic show. And I just want to play, because you played a violinist, a street violinist there, and you sang too. So I just want to play a little music here. This is This City. It's actually from your 2018 album, An Evening with Lucia Micarelli. And this is one of your favorite songs from the show. Again, it's on the album, but it's also been on the show as well.
This city won't ever die, just as long as her heart beats strong. Like a second line, stepping high, raising hell as we roll along. Gently to the Bucharest, low night, central city uptown, singing Giacomo Finani. Drown. Don't matter, cause there ain't no way I'm ever gonna leave this town. This city won't wash away. This city won't ever drown. This city won't wash away. This city won't ever drown.
Well, that's Lucia Micarelli singing This City, a song which was featured on HBO's Tremé. That version is from her 2018 album. Lucia, we've just got a couple minutes here before I have to take a break, but I just want to remind folks that you played Annie Tallarico, right, on Tremé. Mm-hmm. And you've said that being on that show totally blew open your musical world. How did it do that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't know. I thought New Orleans music was a genre. Before I did
like
that show.
Big thing.
And I went down. Yeah, I was like, there's jazz, there's classical, there's New Orleans music. And then I get down there and it's like, oh, there's trad jazz and Zydeco and Cajun and you know, bounce and just like a million different kinds of music there. And the musicians there are so, so generous. And David Simon was just, I don't even know, just so like, just this great combination of being really encouraging and just having blind faith, where he was just like, I'm going to throw you in every musical situation possible. You know, he had this joke about how violin was like hot sauce and it goes with anything. And he just wanted me to play with all of his favorite bands. And so I went down there and was suddenly thrown into, you know, I'm playing with a trad jazz band this week and I'm playing with a Cajun band next week. And I'm playing, you know, it was so many different kinds of things that I had just never done before. And to learn about that music from those musicians in New Orleans and that specific energy, not just their generosity musically, but, you know, this goes back to what I was talking about before, about like, what is the point of music? It was really doing Tremé that I started thinking about that, because, you know, after having just such a classical sort of upbringing and then going to New Orleans and realizing how much music is a part of life. Music is not just recital and performance and perfection and practicing something, you know, and then performing it. It's so ingrained in so many parts of life down there. And that spirit is so beautiful and really, really made an impact on me.
Well, I want to talk more about that when we come back, but we have to take a quick break here. We are speaking with Lucia Micarelli. She's a fabulous virtuoso violinist, and as you heard, she was also spent 4 seasons on Tremé as well, HBO's Tremé. We're going to go into the break listening to Emmanuel. This is Lucia Micarelli's and Chris Bode's performance of the song. 8 million views on YouTube. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hi, this is Peter Sagal. For 20 years, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me has been making fun of the news with comedians and celebrity guests. We got silly limericks. We got terrible impressions. If you think the news is a joke, wait till you hear our show. New podcast episodes are available every Saturday.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, that is violinist Lucia Micurelli performing with cellist Vanessa Freebairn-Smith, a sonata for violin and cello. It's from Lucia Micurelli's 2018 album, An Evening with Lucia Micurelli. And Lucia's with us today from Pasadena, California. And you know, sometimes, Lucia, I think it's probably a good thing that I'm on the radio because people can't see me like bopping and bouncing and moving, but it's impossible to sit still hearing that. What a lovely piece of music.
It's really cool, right? I love, you know, what's so cool about that piece, one of the things I really love about that particular piece is it's part of the traditional classical repertoire, but it's Ravel.
Right.
It was written a long time ago, but it's very modern and exciting. And, you know, I put it in the show because I fell in love with it when I was a teenager because I thought it sounded like rock and roll. And this was before I'd ever heard rock and roll. But what I love about doing it in my show now is, you know, I have a fairly non-classical audience, but sometimes people bring their kids who are learning instruments, and their kids are always so into this piece. And this particular piece is always one of the big hits in my show. And I love bringing this classical repertoire to people who maybe haven't heard it before and showing them that, you know, classical music isn't all like elevator, you know, or like being in some weird gilded library and having to be quiet. It's really diverse, and it's really exciting, and it's very alive still.
Yeah. You know, before the break, we were talking about your four seasons as a main character on Tremé. And I think around that time, I read that you in an interview that you did when you were talking about all the new kinds of music that you were introduced to while doing that show, mm-hmm. there's a quote from you. I want to just ask you about it quickly, because you said, you know, if you've been trained to listen to mistakes your whole life, you forget to listen to opportunities. And so the mm-hmm. kind of music and the way you were learning it in New Orleans was just like totally different than how your brain had been previously wired.
Mm-hmm.
And can you tell me more?
And people,
yeah.
Well, no, just that the musicians there were so open with me, and they sort of helped me focus on, instead of, you know, I had been so perfectionistic up until that point, and they were just kind of like, that's not what it's about. What it's about is like, you know, I learned, my dad taught me this song, and now I'm teaching you this song. So in that moment, it's about history. Or what it's about in this moment is, you know, in New Orleans, they have this thing called a second line. When someone dies, mm-hmm. after the funeral, there's a band that goes out into the street and walks through the streets. This band walks through the streets playing, and the entire funeral party dances behind the band through the streets in celebration of this person's life. And, you know, so in a lot of cases in New Orleans, music is about celebration, or about mourning, or it's about family, or sometimes it's just about eating. Sometimes a bunch of people get together to make food, and while they're waiting for the food to cook, they just play music on the porch. And just this idea of music being about life, and being about people, and being about sharing, and being about listening and communicating. You know, it's not that I didn't know that classical music was about that as well in my training. It's just, it was a good reminder, because right. sometimes, you know, when you're working at something for such a long time, and especially in the classical world, there's so much pressure on technique and achievement and perfection. It's good to be reminded of what music actually means to most yeah. people.
Can I just jump in here for a second?
You know,
can I just jump in? Because listening to you describe sort of how this view that you have of music overall, it seems to fit really perfectly with our times right now, because I suppose maybe a generation or two ago that, you know, most people who went to classical music concerts would be expecting one certain thing. But now, you know, we're living in a world where you can pretty much access any kind of music that you want at any time, right? And so mm-hmm. I wonder if people just are naturally, you know, folks who come to your concerts are more musically omnivorous as it is, and what you're, you know, the shows that you do now just reflect that.
Yeah, I absolutely think so. I think that, just like you said, I think the way that we consume music now is so different than it used to be. You know, it used to be that you could ask somebody what their favorite music was, and they would say a genre. They would be like, I like jazz, period. You know, these days, everybody's answer is, oh, I listen to everything. And we do have everything available to us at all times. And so most people's playlists are extremely diverse. And then, you know, on the flip side of that, I've noticed even in the classical world that the younger artists these days are so much more diverse than they used to be. You know, I've seen like classical musicians play like a Brahms concerto with a symphony and then as an encore play a folk song from their hometown in Finland or play, you know, and I just love that. I think that this is just what's happening in society right now. And I love it. I think it gives artists an opportunity to be a lot more personal and really show their audiences who they are and where they're from and what they're about. And I think that for audiences, it's just this huge amount of consumption of all different kinds of music, which I think is fantastic.
It's awesome, if you ask me. Let's go to a caller.
It's really exciting. Yeah.
Steve is calling from Mandeville, Louisiana. You're on the air, Steve.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi. It's going great. Steve, we're with you. Go ahead.
Yeah, Lucia, I'm very proud to hear your obvious love for our area of the world here, down here around New Orleans. Talking about the woman before about the nerves, don't you think a whole lot of the training that people went through in the classical music genre of that they're terrified of a mistake? And I adore going to see a concert where the musician makes a mistake. You know, our joke is as long as it's not a train wreck, so what?
Yeah.
You know, it's a chance.
Right.
It's an opportunity for being creative. And okay, they made a mistake. You know, I've been a recording engineer and a live reinforcement engineer and a musician all of my life. Well, most of my life. I'm getting old now. But it's incredible to see somebody just be able to make a mistake and roll on.
And roll with it. Yeah, absolutely. Steve, thank you so much for your call. Lucia, do you have a quick response to him?
Yeah, no, I just absolutely agree with that. And you know, it's again, and it goes back to, because what is the point? Is the point to recite something perfectly and show what how I don't know, that seems so ego-driven to be like, look at how perfectly I did this thing. Whereas the point is really, are we connecting? Are we communicating? Am I sharing something with an audience right now? And, you know, I recently read this, I'm obsessed with Yo-Yo Ma. And recently I read a quote of his where he said, perfection isn't very communicative.
Uh-huh.
And I loved that because it's so true. It's like these moments of vulnerability, and not to say like the more mistakes you make, the more your music's going to connect, but just to be able to be in a place where you're communicating from vulnerability and from authenticity means that you don't have your ego there, means you're not thinking about, you know, what do they think? What do they think of me right now? Did I do this right? You're just focused on getting your message across through that music.
So Lucia, this is the perfect segue to the next piece of music that I want to play. I mean, speaking of communication and vulnerability and connection, this is, again, from your 2018 album, An Evening with Lucia Micarelli, and it's Time After Time.
I only know what I know. The passing years will show. You've kept my love so young, so new. And time after time, you'll hear me say that I'm so lucky.
Lucia Micarelli singing Time After Time. Obviously, the version written for Frank Sinatra, not Cyndi Lauper's version. But Lucia, when I heard the story behind this song, it's one of your father's favorites, is that right?
Yeah, and my dad had Parkinson's. He passed away a few years ago, but he had Parkinson's, and in his last few years of having Parkinson's, he lost his ability to speak. He was having such a difficult time remembering words and putting together sentences that this once very sort of, he was always like the star of the party, you know, and he was extremely verbal and very, very, very bright. He just couldn't talk anymore. And one day when I went to go visit him, I had my violin with me, and I don't know why I hadn't thought of doing this earlier. I really regret that I didn't do it earlier, but I went to go visit him. I had my violin, and I just started playing some Christmas carols because it was around Christmas time, and he just started singing along, and it was already after, you know, like a year where he hadn't been speaking. Suddenly, he was singing, and he remembered all the words, and it was incredible, and so I just started playing all these songs, and then I talked to my mom and found out what some of his favorite songs throughout his life had been. And of course, there was a lot of Frank Sinatra. My dad is an Italian man from Queens. And so, you know, I learned all these standards, and I would go and visit him and play this music, and we would like sing together. And so even though we couldn't talk, we were able to have music together and connect through music. And it was really incredible to me. It really, again, was just such an amazing experience. And in that experience, I realized actually how many other people have had similar experiences. That's part of why I do it in my show. It's always very hard to sing that song, and I'm usually very emotional, but I do it because so many other people have had experiences like this with people in their families who've had, you know, dementia or Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. And music is a very, very powerful tool to connect with people sometimes when words don't work anymore.
So, Lucia, there's one more story, at least an update that I want to get from you before we have to wrap up here, because you've obviously had such an incredible career so far. You've got many, many decades ahead of you, for sure. And I'm so excited to see what you do in the future. But your career, were you worried that it could have come to an abrupt end because of a terrible hand injury you had, what, just before Treme started getting underway? Is that right?
Yes, I was on tour with Chris Botti, and we had just done a show, and it was after the show, and I was backstage, and I tripped on my gown while I was holding a glass in my left hand, and I tripped on the gown and just like landed on the glass, and I severed three nerves in my left hand. I had to have like reconstructive nerve surgery, and then I was in a cast for a while. And while I was in the cast, nobody could really tell me, you know, I just remember constantly every time I'd have a visit with my doctor, just asking him, like, am I going to be able to play?
So
we just didn't know. Even now, I don't actually have full feeling in those three fingers. I only have partial feeling. But so,
wait, this is not in your bow hand. It's the other.
This is in my left hand.
Your left hand.
The fingering hand. Yeah.
How is it that you play with only partial feeling in three fingers?
You know, apparently it's not that big of a deal. I thought it was going to be. I didn't know. It sounded like it would be a big deal. You know, I think a lot of it is just like I have muscle memory and. Also, I do have full mobility. I got really lucky, and I didn't sever any like tendons or anything that would affect my mobility. So I have full mobility. I don't have full feeling, but you know, I don't really notice it when I'm playing. I notice it a lot more when I'm like folding laundry. You know, like I can tell when a fabric is like rubbing up against my fingers. I can tell like some of my fingers feel a little strange, but I got really, really, really lucky.
Wow.
But it did also change, you know, just even that, just having that, something that I thought I would always do my entire life, to suddenly realize that, you know, you don't necessarily have forever with anything. And so, you know, that's also sort of, I think, reignited my love and my passion for music. And I'm much more grateful to be able to play. When I'm playing, I'm much more grateful for it than I think I ever was.
Well, we just got a minute to go here, and we've got comments coming in online. I should say on Twitter, Marie Brown says, OMG, I'm adding her to my Apple Music playlist. How I've never heard of you before is beyond me. and someone calling themselves Sick of the Chit says, Lucia, please tell me you also sing. Obviously, she does. Sick of the Chit. We played a couple songs. Now, she has the blues, fingers crossed. I mean, we've got 30 seconds left, Lucia. Let me just use her question to ask you. I mean, what's the next kind of genre of music you want to tackle or explore?
I mean, I'm just always discovering stuff all the time. I've been really into folk music lately. Yes, I do love the blues. You know, I'm just always trying to look for things and see, you know, what feels good to me. You know, my only rules for what I will program or what I will play is that I have to feel a real connection to it and I have to really, really love it. And then I just always hope that if I really love something, I will present it with love and hopefully the audience will love it too.
And you'll shred on the violin. Absolutely. Well, Lucia Micarelli, it has been such a pleasure to speak with you. Lucia's new album is An Evening with Lucia Micarelli. It's set for wide release later this month. Again, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Likewise.
Lucia.
Thank you so much, Magna.
And we have to unfortunately wrap up this hour, but let's do it in style. This is Lucia Micarelli's rendition of Kashmir by Led Zeppelin, of course. It's this version from her latest album, An Evening with Lucia Micarelli. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.